Vectis Radio.
Welcome to Maggie Talks To, a series of in-depth conversations with people who live and work here on the Isle of Wight.
I'm here with Ian McLaughlin, aka Ian Mac, and we're going to have an in-depth conversation. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Maggie.
How are you?
I'm okay, thanks.
Good. First question I'm going to ask you is, were you born here on the island?
No, I wasn't. I was born in Aden.
Right.
Obviously, the Yemen. And that was because my mother and father were in the services and were based at Steamer Point. And how far do you want me to go?
So how old were you when you came here to the island?
I was around 3 months old. It was roughly around about this time of the year, winter time. And I had to wait until then because I hadn't had any injections, inoculations. So I had to stay where I was until I was 3 months old at least so I could travel. So we travelled back when – there's quite a long story to it actually, because there was a program, a drama about 7 or 8 years ago, and it was called The Last Post, and it was all about all the army – peeps that were based in Aden in, you know, the mid-60s. And we were actually the last family to leave. I actually left on an army flight, and by all accounts, I was passed from soldier to soldier.
Pass the parcel?
Yeah, a bit like pass the parcel, yeah. My mum was a bit miffed because the last post was about the last family that left. And we were the last family and we weren't in the programme.
Oh, never mind, eh? So you went to school locally?
I went to school. I lived on Pan. First school was Barton, and Barton Primary School until I was 9. Then we went 200 yards up the road to Downside.
The middle school?
And to the middle school. And our house was literally, you know, 5-10 minutes walk away.
So you didn't have to get the bus then?
No. I didn't have to get a bus, but it did take us – sometimes it took us longer in the summer if we decided to stop off and do a bit of scrumping.
As if you would. And then you went to Carisbrook or Medina?
I went to Medina. And we were – I think we were the third lot in into Medina. A school opened in 76. We went there in 78. So we were the third year there. So that gives you a rough idea of how long Medina has been around.
Yeah, a long time, isn't it? So did you have any aspirations when you were at school as to what you would do when you left? Did you want to be a pilot or a train driver? Or
all I wanted to do when I was really young, probably till I was about 13, was be a professional footballer. And I was in the school team at Barton, school team at Downside. And then when you go to like a big school like Medina, you have all these other middle schools. And that was quite challenging to get in the team. I then decided that it wasn't for me then. I decided to take on a paper round, and that funded buying records. And that from that gave me this real buzz about music and radio.
And what is your favourite music at that time?
At that time, we grew up with the punk era. There was also disco as well. I liked anything and everything.
Anything and everything?
Yeah. Yeah, Squeeze. They were good. Is that what you were trying to lead me on to?
No, I could
talk. I love it, Squeeze.
Right.
Yeah, started in about 1978, completely by accident. I had an album, and I can't remember what the album was called, and this guy came in, one of my brother's mates, Colin Pitfield. There's a name from the past, and he wanted to swap this particular album, and he gave me a Squeeze album because I had a Squeeze single, Call for Cats. So he gave me it was just called Squeeze, and I played it and thought, love it, and then bought more, and ever since then I've just been a big fan of Squeeze.
What, everything they've done?
Most things, some of the stuff in later years have been a bit sort of well below par.
Yeah, but they can't do everything perfectly, can they?
No.
No band can.
No. I think their top, their best era was probably late 70s, early 80s, and the early 90s when they made a bit of a comeback with Paul Carrack.
And what did you do after you left school, eventually?
Crikey. I left school at the age of, it was probably about 3 weeks before my 16th birthday, and I got a job at a place called Solent Gas Turbines, which was just a load of old aeroplane engines that we were in the process of like stripping down, and I got £30 a week.
How?
£30 a week with just stripping down with a spanner and stuff. And it was only there for about 6 weeks. That was my very first job, and strangely enough, that was where Platform One is now.
All right.
Yeah. So and Platform One, as you know, is used to be. Where we are broadcasting from now.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? So after that 6 weeks, where did you go?
I went to the Isle of Wight College for 3 months, and I learnt engineering for some unknown reason. And then after that, January the 4th, 1982, I started work as a boat builder, probably about 300 yards away from the Vectis Radio Studios where they're situated now.
Right. So did you actually build a boat?
Yes, built a boat.
From scratch?
Well, I was like the nipper, because I was only 16 at the time, so I learned a lot. Worked with a guy called Ian Ward, who's sadly no longer with us, and the designer's name was Alistair Hunter, who still lives on the island. He was a big boat designer. And we actually designed and built a boat. It was a 32-foot Unk. That's what it was called.
An Unk?
An Unk. And it was for, I've got to remember his name. He was in a film with Albert Steptoe, in a Beatles film, Richard. Oh, I can't remember his name. But we built a boat for his son, Tom. He was a big jazz fan. And he had this boat, sailed halfway across the world, and it sunk.
Oh, the Unk.
The Unk sunk. Sadly, but he was all right. He was rescued. And people would say, is that down to your welding? But no, certainly not. It was tested.
Right. That's interesting though, isn't it? And then what did you do in the boat building?
Well, I was only there for about 5-6 years. And then I got made redundant. And then I worked at a supermarket in Wootton for a period of time. I got removed from there because I refused to work Christmas Day.
I can't say I blame him.
And then after that, it was just me working in pubs, clubs, and, making a living that way for a period of time.
Doing what?
Discos, mainly. Discos here, there and everywhere. Nightclubs, when we had them. We had 35-plus back in the day. And obviously, we haven't got any now.
No. Did you have the records to carry around everywhere?
Yes, records. When people say that they've got, like, records, and they say thousands of records, and people have said this to me in the past, I know what a thousand records looks like because you carry them everywhere.
They're heavy, aren't they?
Yeah. And you've got to have, like, substantial boxes, which obviously adds to the weight as well. And I think back then, I wouldn't have changed it because I love the fact that It was exciting to pull a record out of a sleeve, put it on, put the needle on, cue it up and so on. Whereas nowadays, if you're going out to do a gig now, it's all in your pocket.
Yeah.
For a start. You don't have to walk up 3 flights of stairs with 3 heavy boxes with proper weight. You earned your money back then. You really did.
So did they have a DJ booth or did you have to take your equipment with you?
Some of the clubs obviously had DJ booths. The one that stands out for me was the one at Brookhouse. It used to be called Brookhouse and they changed its name to Floyd. And it had like a lorry cab that looked like it had been crashed through the wall. And that's where all your unit was. You put your records in there. You put your decks in there. You had your light controller in there. It looked spectacular. It was just in a bit of a rundown club.
And were there lots of people in these clubs?
Yeah, I would say that they were busy nights. They were quite established. Brookhouse was very, I mean, it's been around for years and years. I also worked at the Ride Queen, which was again, you know, busy.
Another boat that sunk.
And the boat that sunk, which actually had two nightclubs and a restaurant at the back, and it could house, they say you could get 1,000 people on it. And there were times, you know, in the summer, peak of summer, it was really rammed. And yeah, in the wintertime, it wasn't quite so because of the old gravelly lane. Because that lovely lane that they built wasn't always there. It was a horrible lane. Used to stop people from coming down, especially if you got a half-decent car. And they were taken over back in about 1988. And most the people that took the club over were more interested in the marina side. So they came in and closed the club after they built the road. And we all thought, oh, people are going to start coming down, coming back to the Ride Queen again. But then they closed it New Year's Eve 1989.
Seems a bit short-sighted, doesn't it?
It does. But I always remember the guy that used to run the club back then, his name was Mr. Webb. We only knew him as Mr. Webb. And he said, the trouble with the Isle of Wight is that there are too few people chasing too many nightclubs.
Right.
And that was true back then. But now we've got no nightclubs, and I don't know where the people go.
They must go somewhere. So where are we up to in our years now? We're up to 89?
Yeah, we're probably looking at 89, and then I started work at Plessy.
Oh, right.
Siemens Plessy. I was a packer. There's probably, out of all the jobs that I had that wasn't anything to do with radio or working in a club, that was probably my favourite job.
So what did you pack?
All sorts of things. And this is from little tiny little things that you would have to put into a box. Just say, for instance, we had a lot of stuff that went to Egypt. So it would go into a box that was, it would have to be sealed. It would have to be airtight, watertight, and so on. And then you had the bigger, the things that if you used to go down past Plessy's, you used to see all these turning gears that would be up in the air spinning around, great big metal contraptions. And you would have to put that on a base, a box base, a wooden base, and then you would have to cover it in plastic. Then you would have to, you'd have to tape up all the sharp bits. Then you put some, what we would call double bag around it, which was like proper thick plastic. Put that around it, seal it, suck all the air out, and then box it up. So it was all bolted into this box. It was clever stuff, and someone had to come along and sign off what you had done. So it was all done properly, and then it was sent halfway around the world.
And whilst you were at Plessy, did you still do your DJing? Or
I did. I was I probably moved on to Barney's Roadhouse by then, and so
Where?
Which was Atherfield Way.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. It was probably the best club that I've worked at. Loved it out there. And I must admit, I did do Thursday, Friday, Saturday. So come Monday, I was a little bit tired. So I did now and again take Mondays off.
Oh, gee, because you were poorly.
No, because I was just tired.
And was it good pay?
Well, back then, just to turn up with your records, you're probably on £35 a night.
That's not bad, is it, for that time?
No, it's not bad. Bear in mind, we're talking 30-plus years ago.
Yeah.
I always thought it was fairly decent.
Yeah, sounds very good. We'll take a little break there, and we'll be back with some more in a minute.
Vectis Radio.
Oh, welcome back from the ads. Where were we?
Probably about 1992.
It was the Roadhouse.
Oh, I was at the Roadhouse.
Yeah. Were there any other nightclubs that you enjoyed going to at that time? Were there any you didn't like going to?
I went to a lot of them. I played at a lot of them. The only one that I didn't play at, and I was really quite sad because it was my favourite nightclub, was Zany's. Sandown Seafront, that was just brilliant. That came at a time when all the freaky futuristic music was really, really big. And I went there numerous times and thought, wow, I'd love to play here. But it's the only place I never played.
I don't like you then.
I was probably too young at the peak. And then by the time 1992, I think they closed down. I did turn up there on the last night it was open, and it was a wreck inside. It was a mess inside.
Oh,
I'm glad I went because, you know, it was, although it was sad, I was, you know, there on the last night, and it was just a horrible sight. And what it was before was just an amazing place with, you know, the music was great. The dress code was superb. The more freaky you dressed, you got free drinks, you got free entry and so on. Yeah, it's one of my biggest regrets is not having a role there at some point.
And did you have freaky clothes?
No.
Oh.
My friend did. I mean, he got in free every week. I mean, he had the most amazing clothes and I was just turning up in a, you know, the normal jeans, T-shirt, whatever.
So after Plessy, what happened?
Oh, that is a question. I decided that I wanted to go all international, a bit like Trotters Independent Traders.
All right.
So I contacted people and I got a job working in a nightclub in Egypt. Cairo.
Right.
And people sold me that I was daft. They've told me that quite often in my life, but I just wanted to prove that I could do it. I did go over and I worked in a nightclub that was part of a really large hotel in the grounds of Cairo Airport. It was a Mövenpick hotel. They had marble floors. It was really plush. They used to call you Mister every morning. It was Mister, and because you were their DJ, you'd be treated like you get all the best food. You get the drinks quicker than anyone else. It was great. Absolutely loved it. But it was a huge culture shock to me. And when I got out there, it was probably August, September time. And they said that they're closing the club for Ramadan. And I said, what do I do during the course of Ramadan? Because it's quite a lengthy spell.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any answers. So I decided, well, I'll come home then, you know, because I don't want to be sat there sitting around doing nothing. And, I decided I was going to come home. I was there for a nine-month contract. I did 6 months. And they decided to get the ump with me because, you know, they didn't want me to go. They thought it was really bad of me to leave. But I just said, well, you can't tell me where my next job's going to be. And you're making me do nothing for 3 months. It's not going to be good for me. So I'm coming home. And they were one of the last days I was there, because all your food was bought and paid for. It was buffet style. And they took me into the office and they said, you owe X amount. And I said, how can I owe X amount if you're supposed to put me up? And they said, because you terminated your contract. So they said I owed thousands of pounds, which I didn't. I don't my money. I don't my, you know, food and board and so on. And I started getting a little bit grumpy. Bearing in mind, I'm only 22. I'm in a strange country all by myself. And all of a sudden, two policemen came in. And they're not like normal policemen back here. You know, they carry the odd truncheon maybe. They had guns. And that was a leveler. That was really quite scary. Anyway, the long and short of it was they had my passport. I owed them money. And they needed me. I needed to get out of the country. Someone within the hotel had managed to put me onto a plane. I got my passport and they said, be in your room at a certain time and we will come and collect you. They come and collected me in a thing on wheels where they put the towels in.
Oh, yeah.
So they chucked me in there, put the towels on top, got me out of the hotel, got me a taxi. I got to the airport and I didn't really breathe a sigh of relief until we were in the air. Because I didn't know what was going to happen.
No, a bit scary.
It was scary. So I vowed that I would never go back to Egypt and the wife wants to go there next year.
All right. I don't think they'll remember you now.
No.
And what happened after all that? You came home and then what?
I came back and it was hard. It was, I never had any jobs. I'd given up the one job that I liked with outside of radio because it was just a burning ambition to work in a nightclub and make it my full-time job.
I came back and I was doing gigs, built the road show up again. And then I decided that I was going to contact Andy Shaw at Isle of Wight Radio and say, I really want to do radio. That's my burning ambition. And I did send him quite a number of tapes. And he, in the end, said, oh, for God's sake, come in and see me. So I did. And,
because you pestered long enough.
Well, there's a message to young people. If you want to get in radio, then, you know, don't you pester and you keep doing it until, you know, you get told absolutely no way or come in and see me. You know, too many people give up at the first hurdle. I didn't. I went in and I set myself a target. I wanted a job in radio and I was prepared to say, right, this is a year that I'll put myself out. I'll train hard, listen and do as much as I possibly can. And hopefully, fingers crossed, this time, you know, in 12 months, I'll have a paid job. And it took me 9 months. So I was really quite chuffed. But I will be forever grateful for Andy for taking me under his wing and molding me into something that, you know, you look at what we are on radio. We are friendly, polite, and so on. When you're working in a nightclub, especially when I worked in a nightclub, I was a bit edgy, a bit naughty, a bit risky sometimes because you could do that. And that's what people expected and in some ways people wanted. Now it's a hell of a lot different. So he molded someone that was, you know, had a lot of molding to do. Because I was working this way. You know, there was one night I remember this young lady coming in and said, oh, there's so-and-so. She's wearing that red dress again and she's giving me the thumbs up and she's on the dance floor giving it large. And I said, yeah, you wore that last week. I didn't mean anything nasty by it. She got the ump, complained. And my boss said to me, yeah, but look how many people were laughing. It was fun. I wouldn't do it now because I realise now that, you know, life has changed. But that's what it was back then. It's different now.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, how life does differ as you go through it. So you were at Isle of Wight Radio and you were being moulded. Yeah. Did you enjoy that? Did you work with nice people?
I worked with some incredibly talented, gifted people.
Mm-hmm.
Most were nice. And I know that, you know, when you hear Andy, I have two things. I have a yardstick with that. With Andy, Andy would do everything by the book, everything professional, everything by the book. And then you had the other end of the scale. You work with Alex Dyke, who I thought was incredibly talented, but at times just sort of lost his way where the actual line was. And I think that is somewhere where I pitch myself somewhere in between.
In the middle, yeah. And do you think you were successful in doing that?
I think so. I mean, I had a 16 years at Isle of Wight earning a decent wage, you know, covering all shows. I mean, I was known as what's called the swing shift jock. And I would be, so if people were off sick, I would get the shout, do breakfast, mid-morning, afternoon. And it would be better than having an actual role of just doing the breakfast show.
Yeah.
Because you could find yourself not so much going stale, but if you're doing breakfast every day and getting up every day, it's quite tiring.
Yes.
So I had the best of both worlds. It was great. I probably made, and I know I did, I ended up doing more shows than anyone else during the course of a year. And we were paid by the show back then. So it was more profitable for me.
Absolutely.
And when a job did actually come up, a proper full-time job, they advised me not to take it purely and simply because it wouldn't be beneficial to you. So I didn't. I continued. But in the end, I did breakfast. I took that on as a role. And it was hard. It was hard. It was, the hours weren't long, but I'm not a very good sleeper. So my sleep patterns was completely messed up with getting up at 5:30 in the morning. So, but I enjoyed it. I mean, it was fun. And I say, not long after that, I decided that I was going to leave purely and simply because other people were being asked to leave. And I thought it won't be long before you might ask me to leave. So someone offered me a job at YFM and I decided that I was going to go before maybe I was pushed. And I ask myself now, because it's the million-dollar question, do you think you made the right decision?
And do you?
And in hindsight and watching how things changed at Isle of Wight, yes, I don't think I made a bad decision. I think it was the right decision, possibly too early, but it was the right decision. And that's, and I say, how things have changed in radio now. There's a lot of, you know, cross stations, people on other stations that are on local stations, the local station. And the model is there's three or four stations with lots of or a few people that are working across all of them. And the amount of people that were working at Isle of Wight all those years ago, it was probably about 25 people there on a daily basis. You had your sales team, you had your news team, you had your presenters propping in, you had people working behind the scenes. And we did visit, and this isn't a dig at Isle of Wight. I mean, all I will say to them is they steered the ship through some choppy waters. It's an expensive time to run a radio station, and it's a difficult time. Lots of stations have gone to the wall. Many FM licenses were given back, but they've managed to steer the ship through those choppy waters.
Which is good.
And they've had to do it for that reason.
So whilst you were there at Isle of Wight Radio, did you have a choice of the music you played, or did you have to play what you were told to play?
I was told what to play. We had our log. And there's two stories I could tell you. One is one day the program controller, the regional program controller came into the studio, and everyone was told to be on their best behavior. And he came in, sat opposite me, just as I was about to do a feature, which I brought in a record from home. And it was something that the station hadn't got. And it was called Vintage Vinyl. And I was told, no Vintage Vinyl. And anyway, he came in and sat down. And he said, what are you doing now then, Ian? And he caught me. I was queuing up my Vintage Vinyl. It was because most of the stuff was on a CD, on CD racks. And I just decided I was queuing up this vinyl. So we're winding it on, winding it back, a third of a turn. And he said, that's vinyl. He said, well, what are you doing playing vinyl? And I said, oh, it's Vintage Vinyl. It's a little feature that I do. It's a song that the radio station hasn't got, but other people. And I said, people will go, oh, I haven't heard that for a long time. He said, great, what are you playing? I said, Tom Robinson, Radio. He said, oh, fantastic, I haven't heard that for a long time. And I thought, well, that's it. He didn't come in and get stroppy and fire me. So, you know, that in some instances, if you know what you're doing with music, I mean, you could pick an old B-side of something that no one's ever heard of, and that might annoy a few people and lose a few listeners. So that's one story, and maybe I'll tell you the other story later.
Why, are you scared?
No, I'm getting a nod from the sound guy that's telling us we got to end this part.
Okay, we're going to go into a break now, and we come back in a minute or two.
Vectis Radio.
So we're back here with Ian again, and after 16 years at Isle of Wight Radio, you went off to another radio station.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
Wight FM. It was based at Lake and started there in the February, and by the September it had closed.
Oh, dear.
I could go into massive detail, but while I was there, I thought, this isn't working. For some reason, it isn't working, but it should do. And I just had the idea, if this falls through, I'm going to give it a crack.
Okay.
So I did. I decided that I was going to take all of the music off my CDs and build a library.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the first thing you've got to do. And in May of 2009, that's what I did. I created a library, thousands and thousands of songs, and started to build the idea. I was doing nothing at the time. I was earning nothing. Well, we kept going until the September 2009. So for about 4 months, I had this plan that if it fell through, I just had something else that we could go for.
Right.
And then we contacted a guy called Mike Smith at the Key Arts Centre and said, this is what we're thinking about doing, Steve Ray and I. And we then found ourselves visiting a bank manager to go for a £10,000 loan so that we could set up a radio station that didn't have a name at that time.
Right.
When it got to late 2009, we decided that we went around all the houses of, renaming other stations and making it fit. And we thought Vectis is probably because of the history and the Roman name and so on. We thought it was perfect. And I do remember someone saying to me, "You'll never get anywhere with a name like that." There we are.
And you started out in a broom cupboard.
If you go into the Key Arts Centre, you go across the wooden bridge, and there's the toilet on the left and the little cupboard on the right hand side. That's where we were. You could spread out your arms. You could touch both sides. That was our station, not just the studio. It was the whole place.
Was it just you on the air?
No, at first it was my good friend. I'd managed to draft my best friend Martin Bully Bull across from Isle of Wight. And it was him. There was a few others, Chris Mew, another voice that was no longer Isle of Wight, but came and joined us. And there were a couple of other people from Wight FM as well. So it's probably about half a dozen. We launched with about half a dozen people. And then it grew to probably about 15, 20. And then now here we are, 2025, we've got 35. So
you're no longer in a broom cupboard.
We're no longer in that broom cupboard. We wouldn't fit. Although, our premises are not that big when you think of, a radio station, and we've got a school in it as well. I mean, it's incredible what we achieve in the relatively small space that we have.
It is, actually, yeah. So when you're not on the radio, yeah, and you're not doing anything to do with radio, what else do you do? Like gardening or?
Radio is my hobby, yeah. My life, my job. And I would say that there's not many days that I'm not doing something, whether it's editing, writing something, producing something. When I'm not doing that, the only thing that will get me to relax is sitting in the sun,
mm-hmm.
and listening to an autobiography.
Right.
That's the only thing that will relax me. I do a bit of gardening and a bit of, I love painting, not pictures, but I love painting walls for some unknown reason. It was one of those other jobs that I wished I'd have done, being a painter and decorator, but I can't because I'm colourblind.
Right. So you don't know what colour you're putting on the wall?
Well, I think I do. I mean, there's lots of stories that have, that I've painted and relationships have ended.
Oh, dear. It wasn't quite the right colour?
It was. I was told a hint of, I think it was apple white, and I put aqua green.
Right.
And but we had a peach bathroom set, so that didn't go down very well. So that bathroom had, like, I don't know, four or five coats of paint in a couple of days just to put it right. But we're no longer together.
Oh, well, so. That's all right then. So what are your ambitions for the rest of your life? Do you have any?
Do you know, it's really strange that my accountant upset me about 3 years ago and told me that the time was ticking and, you're going to retire in 10 years' time, 3 years ago. And it kind of focused my mind on a bit more on what to do, because I didn't really think about it. When we first started Vectis, didn't know where it was going to land, didn't know how it was going to turn out. And it was always like survival. It was always every year, right, but next year would be a little bit stronger, a little bit better, a little bit better off, and so on. And it's only in the last couple of years that I've been giving this some real thought. And yes, I have decided, it's no secret now, I have decided that when I am old enough to retire, I will step away and just, I don't know, I've got plans. I want to, this is going to sound really funny, but I see me with a big shed and maybe a big area where I can grow things. Maybe a greenhouse as well, but I want to get myself a white coat, and I want to get all scientific and start pickling things.
All right,
and maybe smoking things as well. Like get a big smoker and so on, and just and I also want to finish my book as well. because my...
What, you're writing a book?
I'm six chapters in, and I've been six chapters in for 10 years, and I haven't had a chance to do it.
Right.
So that's one of the things that I really want to do. One because it's a radio, it's the story of the, you know, the whole radio story. But running alongside that, and I don't know whether it's a good idea to run it alongside it or not, but we started this conversation with where I was born, Aidan. Well, when I was 20, my mum told me that my dad wasn't my dad. And I tracked him down. Eventually, we tracked him down. She told me that when I was 20. I tracked him down when I was 37. Obviously, back in, you know, when I was told originally, back in 1985, there wasn't any internet or anything like that. It was hard to track down people. And then one day I was on the radio and this lady phoned me and she said, are you the son of the... John, who runs the pub at Brading? And I said, not really. and she said, oh, why? And I said, well, it's a long story. Anyway, I told her the long story, and she said, what's his real dad's name? And I said, it's James Oswald Haynes. Date of birth, 1929, 13th of January. So she said, I'll find him. So I said, okay, good luck with that then. A couple of weeks later, she came back to me and she said, I've drawn a blank. Do you know what regiment he was in? So I said, yeah, I got the details, sent the details. And within a couple of days, she had phoned me again and said, have you got a pen? And I said, yeah. She said, take down this number. This is your dad's number. And I thought, wow, that's incredible. So I took down the number and I rung it mistakenly. I rung it and then thought, oh, God, I can't just out of the blue. So I wrote to my father, unbeknownst. I mean, he knew I was around. He knew I was born. I wrote to him. And because my mum obviously had an affair, she was a dressmaker. And she used to make a lot of clothes for people, and she would use dressmaking patterns. Now, these dressmaking patterns were like inside, they come in a big envelope, and inside was all tissue paper.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had hollowed out some of the tissue paper and put a letter inside. So when he came back to this country, he would send my mum letters. And I just said, are you the same James Oswald Haynes that used to send my mum dressmaking patterns? And the reason why I did that was because I didn't want to ruin whatever life he'd had. And if it was an innocent kind of question that if, just say, for instance, he was married, we had no idea, he wouldn't be, you know, under pressure. Straight away got a message back to say, yes, I am he. He wanted my mum's details so he could contact her. So he did. And then he came down, met my mum, didn't go back for 2 weeks. 3 years later, they were married. I was the best man. And then, sadly, a year or so later, he died.
Oh dear!
But this is the bit that I think in a book and a film would be really, really good.
Yeah.
Because when I went to visit him, he had something wrong with his brain. He had a brain tumor, but they weren't sure of what was going on. So they put him in the stroke unit. And the guy who I thought was my dad for 20 years. Was I went up to visit one day and they were opposite in the same ward opposite each other. So they, in 1965 was the last time they saw each other, and there they were, all this history as well. They were sat right opposite, but they didn't know each other.
Uh-huh.
They didn't know each other. I walked up the corridor and I had to do a double take of what was going on. And sadly, they both died 3 weeks later, and they both died of more or less the same thing. So I want to finish my book.
I'm sure you do. So one last question. You've created the 4Ps training school, and that appeared out of nothing really, but it's grown into a huge thing. What made you start on that one?
I met a lady called Marion from St. George's School, and she said, can I send someone from St. George's School for work experience? And it was a young lad called Judd. And cutting a long story short, he couldn't read or write. And we got him to, he was so not very confident at first. And then after a period of time, he was really, really confident. He was doing interviews and so on. And we just thought with what we do with radio, I'd been in radio for quite a period of time and thoroughly enjoyed it. And
he's changed his mind. He's not going to jump
put,
up there.
Put something back into what you've done. Hey, look, this is a great idea. Working with young people, boosting their confidence and communication using the main ingredients of radio.
And it's been a huge success.
Oh, it's probably, I look at what we've done with the radio station and I'm super proud of that, but equally super proud of the achievements that we've all achieved with the 4Ps. I mean, it's just something that's grown and grown and grown. And now we've got like, you know, 12, 13 years of history where you can actually measure the achievements. You know, back then it was really difficult. Back then it was really difficult to measure how far the radio station had come. I mean, 7 golds, community radio golds later, 1 ARIA, which is the biggest thing that we could ever win. The biggest thing as a radio station, as a community radio station you could ever win. And then the icing on the cake is the Queen's Award. And then you've got umpteen awards for the 4Ps as well. I mean, you know, if I had to pick one, I couldn't. Which one's the biggest, the best achievement? They're both incredible because they came out of, like you say, nothing. Yeah. They just came out of an idea.
Brilliant. Like the radio station came out of an idea, didn't it?
Off the kitchen, not this table, but off the kitchen table.
Yeah.
I every now and again, I know that people tell me all the time, you should be really proud. I am, but sometimes you ain't got time to be proud because you've got so many things to do. And it's only when you're sitting down and relaxing or you go on holiday and you realise, you look back and you think, wow, crikey, what an achievement. My mum summed it up very recently and she'd gone through years of never ever telling you that she was proud of you and so on. But recently she said to me, and I think this kind of is equivalent of, you've made your mark, Nipper. And I think that's about right. We've made our mark. And, you know, say 15, 16 years of radio. We've got, you know, 12, 13 years of the school that is a huge success thanks to people that have been supportive and so on. None of it can be possible with it. It's not just one person. There's a team of people. I'm lucky to have a good team of people around me, not just now, but for the last X amount of years.
Yeah.
So we should all be proud of that.
We should, indeed. Do you have a favourite tune that we could play at the end of this?
I do, and it's weird. I love it.
Okay.
There's just something about it that is just lovely. And I want this played when I go eventually, you know, leave this world and so on. I would love to have this song played when people reflect on things. I just think it's a lovely song. It's Kate Bush and Moments of Pleasure.
All right.
It's just got everything in it. She's weird, wacky, and wonderful. And yeah, it's just my, it's got classical in it. It's got her voice in it. It's got a bit of rock in it. It's got everything in it, but it just makes you stop and think. But the amount of people that have said to me and said, yeah, it's a bit weird.
Well, thank you, Ian. It's been really, really interesting. And now we're going to play Kate Bush.
If you would like to hear this or any other of the conversations again, go to the Vectis Radio webpage, vectisradio.com, and you can find it amongst the podcasts.